A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Daniel's been turning over a question that's been nagging at him since we last talked about the military and civilian law enforcement. He points out that political scientists define the state as holding a monopoly on the legitimate use of force. That's the classic Weberian definition. But then he looks at countries like the United States or Israel and sees at least two armed institutions standing right there. The military and the police. So, how do you have a single monopoly when both exist? He wants to know whether the key is that they operate in completely separate legal domains, or if there's a constituted hierarchy between them. And then the deeper question, if the relationship were ever tested by a crisis, what does democratic theory say is supposed to happen? He wants us to unpack how that abstract idea of the monopoly on force actually gets translated into real institutions, legal safeguards, and chains of civilian authority. He suspects it's one of those concepts that's a lot more nuanced than the one-line definition makes it sound.
He's right about that last part. It is. And I think the place to start is with what the definition actually says, because most people hear monopoly on force and picture exactly what Daniel's picturing. One institution, one set of uniforms, one chain of command. But that's not what Weber meant.
What did he mean then?
The monopoly is on the legitimate authorization of force. It's not a monopoly on carrying weapons or wearing a uniform. The state says, only I get to decide when force is legitimate. But I can delegate that authority to multiple institutions. The military, the police, border guards, prison guards, they're all exercising force under a single authorization. The monopoly is at the top, not at the bottom.
So the apparent contradiction Daniel's pointing at, two armed bodies, one monopoly. It's not actually a contradiction. It's more like a restaurant with multiple kitchens but one head chef.
The head chef doesn't cook every dish, but every dish goes out under his authority. Same thing here. The state doesn't swing every baton or fire every rifle, but every use of force traces back to its authorization. The real question isn't whether two armed institutions can coexist under that monopoly. They obviously can. The real question is whether both derive their authority from the same source and remain accountable to it.
Which is where the legal separation comes in. Because coexisting is one thing. Keeping those two kitchens from, I don't know, burning each other's orders is another.
And no, I caught myself, I'll rephrase. The separation is the mechanism. And it's not philosophical, it's statutory. In the United States, the foundational piece of law is the Posse Comitatus Act. 1878. It's codified at Title 18, Section 1385 of the U.S. Code, and it says, I'm paraphrasing, but not by much, that the Army and Air Force can't be used to execute domestic law except where Congress or the Constitution explicitly authorizes it.
Wait, Army and Air Force specifically?
Yeah, the Navy and Marine Corps were added later by Department of Defense regulation, not by the original statute. But the effect is the same across all branches now. The point is, Posse Comitatus draws a bright line. The military fights foreign wars and defends against external threats. The police enforce domestic law. Two domains, two missions, two sets of rules.
And the rule that draws that line is 148 years old.
From the end of Reconstruction, specifically. It was passed after federal troops were used to police elections in the South. Congress wanted to make sure the military couldn't become a domestic police force by default. So they wrote a statute that says, default is no. Exceptions require explicit permission.
Which brings us to the exceptions, because a bright line that's never crossed isn't actually that interesting.
Right, and the biggest exception is the Insurrection Act of 1807. It lets the president deploy the military domestically to suppress insurrection, domestic violence, or to enforce federal law when state authorities can't or won't. It's been invoked dozens of times. The 1992 LA riots, the 1957 Little Rock integration crisis when Eisenhower sent the 101st Airborne to escort black students into Central High School,
Both of those are moments where the line between military and police blurred because the situation overwhelmed the normal separation.
And that's the key word, overwhelmed. The Insurrection Act isn't a casual tool. The legal standard is that there's an obstruction of federal law or a rebellion that makes ordinary law enforcement impossible. When the president invokes it, the military steps into a domestic role, but, and this is the part people miss, it's still supposed to operate under civilian law enforcement rules, not under military rules of engagement.
So the uniform changes, but the legal framework doesn't.
In theory, yes. In practice, it gets messy fast. Soldiers aren't trained in civilian policing. The Uniform Code of Military Justice, the UCMJ, governs military personnel, but it doesn't apply to civilians. So you've got soldiers operating in a domestic context where the people they're dealing with aren't subject to military law, and the soldiers themselves are in this weird hybrid space, subject to both the UCMJ and civilian criminal law depending on what they're doing.
That sounds like an accountability gap wearing a uniform.
It is, and we're seeing that play out right now in a very concrete way. The Trump administration deployed military personnel to Los Angeles, and a federal judge ruled on that deployment. The judge's ruling is essentially the court stepping in to arbitrate where the boundary sits. The administration invoked its authority. The court said, hold on, let's look at the legal basis for this.
What was the specific legal question the judge was looking at?
Whether the deployment fell within the statutory exceptions to posse comitatus. The Insurrection Act has specific triggers. It's not a blank check. The president has to determine that the situation meets the statutory criteria, and then the deployment has to be proportional and time-limited. The judge was examining whether those conditions were actually met, or whether this was an end-run around the separation.
So the court, so the referee, when the executive and the law disagree about where the line is?
In principle, yes. And this is where the constitutional hierarchy Daniel asked about comes in. The president is commander-in-chief of the armed forces. That's Article 2 of the Constitution. But police power is reserved to the states under the 10th Amendment, so there's no simple military over police hierarchy. What there is a federal over state hierarchy in specific, enumerated circumstances.
Walk me through that, because commander-in-chief sure sounds like the top of a hierarchy.
It is, for the military. The president commands the armed forces. But the president doesn't command state police departments or county sheriffs. Those are creatures of state law. The president can't call up the NYPD and order them to do something. What the president can do, under the Insurrection Act, is deploy federal troops into a state when federal law is being obstructed. And at that point, the federal troops are operating under federal authority, which is supreme over state authority under the Supremacy Clause.
So the hierarchy exists, but it's constitutional. Not institutional. It's not that the military outranks the police. It's that federal authority outranks state authority when the Constitution says it does.
And that's the resolution to Daniel's question about whether there's a constitutional hierarchy. There is, but it's not military versus police. It's federal versus state. The military and the police are both instruments. The hierarchy is about who gets to authorize their use, and under what conditions.
Which brings us to Israel, because Daniel mentioned Israel as the other example, and the Israeli setup is genuinely different.
It is. The IDF has a formal domestic law enforcement role in the occupied territories, and in certain home front scenarios, civil defense, disaster response, counterterrorism operations that blur the line between military and police. In the West Bank, for example, the IDF is the primary law enforcement authority. Israeli civilians in the settlements are subject to Israeli civilian law enforced by Israeli police, but the Palestinian population is under military law enforced by the IDF. So you've got two populations in the same territory under two different legal regimes with two different enforcement bodies.
That's not a separation. That's a deliberate entanglement.
It is. And it's a policy choice. Israel could, in theory, maintain a stricter separation in some of those contexts. It doesn't, because the security situation, in the government's view, requires military involvement in what would otherwise be police functions. But the point for Daniel's question is that this shows the separation is a choice, not a logical necessity of the monopoly concept. The monopoly on force can accommodate very different institutional arrangements.
So, the U.S. chose separation with exceptions. Israel chose integration as the default in certain territories. Both still claim a single monopoly on legitimate force.
Right. The monopoly is on the authorization, not on the organizational chart. As long as the state is the one saying this use of force is legitimate, the monopoly holds, whether the force is applied by a soldier or a police officer. The question is whether the chain of authorization is intact and traceable.
Let me push on that word, traceable. Because that seems like the thing that actually matters. If a soldier uses force, and nobody can trace the authorization back to a civilian authority, the monopoly might exist on paper, but not in reality.
That's the accountability problem I was getting at. When the military is deployed domestically, the normal chain of command shifts. In a military operation overseas, the chain runs from the president through the Secretary of Defense to the combatant commander. In a domestic deployment under the Insurrection Act, the military is supposed to operate under the direction of civilian law enforcement authorities, the Attorney General, the U.S. Marshals, or state and local officials. But that's not how the military is trained. The military is trained to operate under military command. So you get this awkward handoff where soldiers are taking direction from people outside their chain of command, and the legal accountability gets fuzzy.
Who investigates a soldier if something goes wrong in that scenario?
That's the gap. The UCMJ covers the soldier, but the incident happened in a domestic law enforcement context, so civilian prosecutors might also have jurisdiction. And the civilian law enforcement agency that was directing the soldier might bear some responsibility. But the legal frameworks don't mesh cleanly. The UCMJ doesn't have a section for when you're temporarily acting as a police officer under the Insurrection Act.
So the exception creates a legal no man's land.
It creates the potential for one. And that's why the courts matter so much in these situations. The judge in the LA case wasn't just ruling on whether the deployment was legal, she was effectively drawing the boundary of the monopoly. She was saying, here's where the state's authorization ends, and here's where it goes beyond what the law permits.
Which is the courts doing exactly what democratic theory says they should do, checking the executive when it reaches beyond its authorized power.
Yes. And this is the deeper theoretical point Daniel was asking about. The monopoly on legitimate force in a democracy isn't just about having a single source of authorization. It's about that authorization being democratic, meaning it flows from the people through the Constitution to the institutions that exercise it. And the institutions are arranged so that no single branch can exercise force without constraint. The president commands the military, but Congress authorizes the funding and declares war and writes the statutes like posse comitatus. The courts review whether the executive's use of force stays within those statutes.
So the monopoly isn't held by the president. It's held by the constitutional order as a whole.
And that's what makes it a democratic monopoly rather than a dictatorship. In a dictatorship, the monopoly on force is personal. It sits with the dictator, who can deploy the military or the police however he wants. In a democracy, the monopoly is institutional. It's distributed across branches, constrained by law, and ultimately answerable to the people through elections.
Which means, when we talk about the monopoly being tested by a crisis, as Daniel put it, the test isn't whether the military gets deployed. The test is whether the deployment stays within the constitutional framework, whether it's authorized, whether it's time-limited, whether it remains under civilian control, and whether the courts can review it.
Every one of those conditions matters. Authorization means Congress or the Constitution said this is allowed. Time-limited means it doesn't become permanent. The Insurrection Act doesn't let the president declare an open-ended military occupation of a U.S. city. Civilian control means the military isn't making policy decisions about who gets arrested or what laws get enforced. And judicial review means someone outside the executive branch gets to say whether the deployment was legal.
The time-limited part seems especially important because that's where a crisis can turn into something else. If the deployment doesn't end, the exception becomes the new normal.
That's the erosion problem, and it's not hypothetical. The Insurrection Act has been invoked for prolonged periods in the past. After Hurricane Katrina, the Stafford Act was used to deploy the military for disaster response. That's a different statute, but the same blurring effect. The military was doing things that looked a lot like law enforcement, and the legal framework was murky.
The Stafford Act is the disaster response one, right?
Yes. It authorizes federal military support for disaster relief, and it's less controversial than the Insurrection Act because it's usually about delivering supplies and providing medical care. But in a big enough disaster, the line between support and law enforcement gets thin. If the military is patrolling a flooded city to prevent looting, is that disaster response or policing?
It's both, and that's the problem.
It's both, and the legal framework doesn't have a clean category for both. That's what I mean about the accountability gap. The statutes were written for clear categories, military here, police there, and the real world keeps producing situations that don't fit the categories.
Let's bring this back to Daniel's core question, because I think we've been circling the answer, and I want to land it. How does a democratic state resolve the apparent contradiction of having two armed institutions while claiming a single monopoly on force?
The resolution is that the monopoly is on authorization, not on arms bearing. The military and the police both derive their authority from the same constitutional order. They operate in separate legal domains by default, posse comitatus for the U.S., with the Insurrection Act as the controlled exception. The hierarchy isn't military over police, it's federal over state in specific constitutional circumstances. And in a crisis, the key safeguard is that the military must remain under civilian authority, the deployment must be legally authorized and time-limited, and the courts must be able to review it.
And if any of those safeguards fails?
Then the monopoly is still there. The state is still the one authorizing force. But it's no longer a democratic monopoly. It's become something closer to executive unilateralism. The authorization is real, but it's not constrained by the constitutional order.
That's the distinction that matters. A dictatorship and a democracy both have a monopoly on force. The difference is whether the monopoly is constrained by law and distributed across institutions.
And whether the people who are subject to that force have a say in who authorizes it. That's the democratic piece. The monopoly is legitimate because it flows from the consent of the governed, not because the state says so.
So when Daniel asks what democratic theory says is supposed to happen in a crisis, the answer is that the crisis is the test of whether the constraints hold. The theory doesn't say the military can't be deployed. It says the deployment has to stay within the constitutional framework, and if it doesn't, the system is supposed to push back. Through the courts, through Congress, through public accountability.
We're watching that test play out in real time. The LA deployment, the judge's ruling, that's the system doing what it's supposed to do. Whether it works, whether the ruling is respected, whether the deployment ends when it's supposed to end. Those are the questions that tell you whether the monopoly is still democratic.
There's a secondary question here that Daniel didn't ask directly, but that's implied in his framing. What happens if the courts and the executive disagree and neither backs down?
That's the constitutional crisis scenario. The courts can rule, but they don't have an army to enforce their rulings. Alexander Hamilton made this point in Federalist 78. The judiciary has neither the purse nor the sword. It depends on the executive to enforce its judgments. So if the executive says, "We disagree with the ruling and we're keeping the troops in place," the courts have no direct mechanism to stop it.
Which means the monopoly on force ultimately rests on a political question, whether the branches of government accept the constitutional order as binding.
Yes. And that's the deepest level of Daniel's question. The legal separation, the statutory carve-outs, the constitutional hierarchy, all of that scaffolding around a more fundamental question. Does the executive accept that its use of force is constrained by law? If the answer is yes, the monopoly is democratic. If the answer is no, the monopoly is still there, but it's no longer constrained, and that's a different kind of state.
The scaffolding matters, though. It's not just decorative. Posse Comitatus has held for 148 years. The Insurrection Act has been invoked, but it's always been temporary. The courts have reviewed deployments. The norms have held, mostly. The scaffolding creates friction against unilateralism, and friction matters.
Friction is the whole game. Democratic institutions are designed to be slow and difficult to override precisely because speed and ease are the tools of authoritarianism. The fact that it's hard to deploy the military domestically isn't a bug. It's the point.
If I'm a listener trying to apply this framework, when I see a news story about military-police cooperation, what questions should I be asking?
Three questions. First, what's the legal authorization? Is there a statute being invoked? The Insurrection Act? The Stafford Act? Something else? Or is this an ad hoc arrangement? Second, who's the civilian authority in the chain of command? If the military is taking direction from a civilian law enforcement official, that's the system working as designed. If the military is operating under its own command without civilian oversight, that's a red flag. Third, is the deployment time limited? Is there a sunset clause, a stated end date, a condition that triggers withdrawal?
If you can't answer any of those three questions from the news coverage,
then the coverage is missing the point. The story isn't, troops are in the streets. The story is, under what authority, accountable to whom, and for how long?
That's a useful mental toolkit. The one-line Weberian definition, monopoly on legitimate force, doesn't give you any of that. It sounds like a description of power, but it's actually a description of a legal architecture.
Weber himself was a lot more nuanced than the one-line summary suggests. He was describing the modern state as a historical development, the process by which the state gradually centralized the authorization of force and eliminated private violence, feudalism, vigilante justice. The monopoly wasn't a static condition. It was an achievement, and it has to be maintained.
Maintained against what?
Against the constant pressure to fragment. Private militias, paramilitaries, mercenaries, armed political factions, all of those are challenges to the monopoly. And the state's response to those challenges is, in a weird way, the same as its response to the military police question. It insists that all force must be authorized through the constitutional order. If it's not, it's not legitimate.
Which connects back to what Daniel was really asking. He wasn't just asking for a definition. He was asking how the abstraction survives contact with reality. How do you take this grand theoretical claim and actually make it work with real institutions, real laws, real people with guns?
The answer is, you build a legal architecture that separates the institutions by default, creates controlled exceptions, distributes authority across branches, and subjects every use of force to review. It's not elegant. It's full of gaps and gray zones, but it's held up better than any alternative anyone's come up with.
The cutting room floor detail I keep thinking about is the Posse Comitatus Act's origin in 1878. It was passed specifically to end the use of federal troops to police elections in the post-Reconstruction South. So the foundational law separating military from police in America was born from a crisis of democratic legitimacy, the exact kind of crisis Daniel's asking about. The separation wasn't a theoretical exercise. It was a response to a real failure.
That's worth sitting with. The law that defines the boundary was written because the boundary had been violated in a way that threatened democracy itself. The abstraction came after the crisis, not before it.
Which leaves us with an open question. If the legal architecture was built in response to a crisis, can it survive repeated crises? The Insurrection Act has been invoked more frequently in recent decades. Domestic military deployments are becoming less exceptional. The norms are under pressure. Is the framework robust enough to handle that, or does it depend on the exceptions remaining exceptional?
I don't know the answer to that. I think we're in the middle of finding out. The LA case will be one data point. The question is whether the system's pushback, the courts, the public debate, the political accountability, is strong enough to keep the exceptions contained. Because if they're not, the exception becomes the rule, and the monopoly changes character without anyone formally abolishing posse comitatus.
That's the quiet way institutions transform. Nobody votes to end the separation. It just erodes.
Erosion is harder to fight than a frontal assault. A frontal assault you can see coming. Erosion just looks like a series of reasonable exceptions until one day you look up and the default has flipped.
If this episode changed how you think about the state's monopoly on force, if it made you realize it's not a simple one-liner, but a whole legal architecture, share it with someone who still thinks it's just about who has the guns.
Thanks to our producer, Hilbert Flumingtop, for keeping us on track.
This has been My Weird Prompts. You can find every episode at myweirdprompts.com.
We'll be back soon.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore. A thought you've never heard before. The host dig in, the host dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too. From half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long ear host. My weird prompts, until next time. Stay curious, keep weird in mind.